turn to Deuteronomy chapter 18. In our last session, somebody told me we covered 8 chapters. I didn't count them, but I think that sounds about right. This session, I hope to cover 9. And that'll leave us one session to cover the final 8 after that. If we cover 9 in this session, we will get through chapter 26. And that will bring us to the end of this second discourse of Moses, and leave, of course, only the final discourse and the epilogue to consider in the next session. We're at chapter 18, and we've been, well, the material we've been looking at has covered quite a variety of subjects. Most recently, the laws that have to do with the judges and their being in subjection to the priesthood, and then moving from that to view the time of the monarchy. Of course, the period of the judges was about 300 years prior to the monarchy, and then the monarchy lasted at least that long. These are both anticipated in chapter 17. The judges would be subject to the priest's judgment about hard cases, and in the case of the king, he was to be of an altogether different spirit than most kings, humble, not one who multiplies military machinery or wives or money for himself, but one who reads daily from the law and governs his conduct by it. Now, in chapter 18, it says, "The priests, the Levites, indeed all the tribe of Levi, shall have no part nor heritage with Israel. They shall eat the offerings of the Lord made by fire and his portion. Therefore, they shall have no inheritance among their brethren. The Lord is their inheritance, as he said to them many times already before this. And this shall be the priest's due from the people. From those who offer a sacrifice, whether it is a bull or a sheep, they shall give the priest the shoulder, the cheeks, and the stomach of the animal, the first fruits of your grain, and your new wine, and your oil, and the first of the fleece of your sheep you shall give him. For the Lord your God has chosen him out of all your tribes to stand to minister in the name of the Lord, him and his sons forever. And if a Levite comes from any of your gates, from where he sojourns among all Israel, and comes with all the desire of his mind to the place which the Lord chooses, then he may serve in the name of the Lord his God, as all his brethren, the Levites, do, who stand there before the Lord. They shall have equal portions to eat, besides what comes from the sale of his inheritance." Now, this anticipates a time when there will be so many Levites that they won't all be able to serve in the tabernacle. I mean, the tribe of Levi was already fairly large, and every male Levite was somehow connected to the service of the tabernacle. It would seem that some of them probably took a lot of time off, because there's only so much work to do. And when they were traveling, of course, the Levites had a lot of work to do, although, again, only a small portion of them probably were busy with each move, but they had to tear down the tabernacle, pack it up, carry it off, and reset it up in the new location. But when they would come into the land of Canaan, they would no longer be moving the tabernacle here and there. They'd set up in a place that the Lord would choose. Initially, this was Shiloh. Later, in David's day, it was moved, at least the ark was moved, to Jerusalem, where in Solomon's day a temple was built instead of the tabernacle. But when the tabernacle was no longer in motion, when it would settle in Shiloh, there'd be much less for the Levites to do. And it's not clear at all what they would do at this point. They would settle in Levitical cities. I believe there were 42 or 48 of those cities designated for the Levites. And those were scattered within all the different tribal areas, which would mean some of them would be near and some of them further from the tabernacle. And the ones that were furthest away, again, it's hard to know exactly how they would occupy their time. Perhaps they would take turns, as was the case later in David's day. David divided the priesthood itself, which only a small segment of the tribe of Levi were the priests. But the priests had become so numerous in David's day that he had divided them into 24 courses, and each course would serve only 2 weeks out of the year in the temple. Now, since the Levites were far more numerous than just the priests, it's hard to know exactly how the Levites occupied themselves. They must have been in semi-retirement most of the time. And it is possible, of course, that they would somehow serve the function of teaching the law to the people in their domain, although it's not certain that they would all have copies of the law available to them to do that with. At a much later date, after the Babylonian captivity, there would be synagogues in every city where there were 10 or more adult Jews, but that wasn't the case in these days. There was only one center of worship until the time of the Babylonian captivity, and that was first the tabernacle, then the temple. Synagogues came up much later, just a few centuries before Christ. So that we're not sure exactly what the Levites did. It may be that they did almost nothing. They were just there, available to the Lord, maybe for people to consult about spiritual matters, you know, sort of nearby religious consultants about practices, Jewish practices or whatever. It's not all that clear, but there was no doubt something they occupied themselves with. And most of them were not occupied with the service of the tabernacle at any one time. Once more, it is possible that they did take shifts. You know, that any one Levite might be serving at the tabernacle 1 week out of the year or something like that. But the rest of the time, he'd just be on standby. But they also had a sacrifice. I mean, it sounds like a pretty much a life of Riley for these guys. They didn't really have to work very hard, it would appear. But then they didn't own much either. They didn't live real luxurious lives. Unlike most Israelites, they had no land. They had cities. But you see, in an agrarian society, land was necessary to produce crops for profit. And all that the Levites had were these cities that were set apart for them where they would have houses to live in. And then there were what were described as suburbs, or certain lands surrounding the cities where their cattle could be, because the Levites were given the firstborn cattle of all of Israel, so they'd have flocks of their own. And they would also eat of the sacrifices. They'd be supported by the sacrifice. Now, when a Jew would offer a sacrifice, of course, a certain part of the sacrifice was unclean and was taken outside the city and burned. Another part of it was burned on the altar. But the remaining section, at least parts of it, were eaten by the priest and parts by the worshiper who brought the sacrifice. The specific parts that belong to the priest are named for us in verse 3 of the parts of the animal, the shoulder, the cheeks, and the stomach, which I'm not sure why those particular parts are chosen, except I think some would find symbolic value in them, but I'm not sure what that value would be. Also, the first fruits of grain and wine, so they'd have a balanced diet made up of the first fruits and the tithes of the people's livestock and their agricultural produce. That would also be added to them, the things that were vowed by the Jews voluntarily. Now, he says there in verse 6 that if a Levite from one of these Levitical cities, far from Shiloh, far from where the tabernacle was, just got it in his heart, as it says, if he wanted, with all the desire of his mind, he wants to go and serve the Lord at the tabernacle, he was entitled to do that. And he could be supported on the tithes there at the tabernacle. So, that is, that's the law about, you know, the survival of the Levites. When we get to verse 9, we have what really takes up the rest of this chapter, a warning that when Moses is gone, the people, of course, will have been accustomed to having Moses around to give them words from the Lord, but they won't have him anymore. And so how will they get words from the Lord? Well, one thing he says in verses 9 through 14, do not seek this kind of guidance from divination. Don't go to the fortune tellers and the seances and things like that to get supernatural revelation. But rather, he says in verse 15 of Paul, and God will send you another prophet, like Moses. And we'll read those right now. Verse 9, well, when you come into the land which the Lord your God has given you, and since Moses was not going to be permitted to go in, they would go there without him and would not have him anymore to consult. You shall not learn to follow the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, or one who practices witchcraft, or a soothsayer, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or one who conjures spells, or a medium, or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. For all who do these things are an abomination to the Lord, and because of these abominations the Lord your God drives them out from before you. You shall be blameless before the Lord your God, for these nations which you will dispossess listened to soothsayers and diviners. But as for you, the Lord your God has not appointed such for you. He's appointed something else, which he goes on to describe starting at verse 15. Now, these practices that are listed are all under the general category of the occult. They all have to do with seeking information that is not accessible through natural means, and therefore consulting supernatural sources of information. The nation of Israel had been accustomed to having access to information beyond that which came from the natural world. They had God. God had appeared to them, had spoken to them, they had a prophet of God leading them. And now they were not going to have quite the same arrangement. And so there would be a temptation if they wanted to know the future or wanted to get some special guidance to do the same thing the Canaanites had done, to go to the occult. Even Christians today have been known to do this, which is, of course, quite wrong. These things are an abomination to God. And the reason that this is an abomination is, I believe, because of the demonic dimension that lies behind them. The Bible doesn't focus on that dimension when it lists them, although it does talk about a medium. In other places, it talks about one who has a familiar spirit, which would be a demon, we assume. There is a demonic element to this, and there's also fakers. I mean, fortune tellers, there's probably at least as many of them are fakes as there are those that are really in touch with demons. But in any case, you're not supposed to go to that. Why would you want to talk to a fake when seeking spiritual information? And even less would you want to go and talk to a demon about things. And so to use these practices, and no doubt others that are not listed, for example, the I Ching or the Ouija board or a number of other things that have come up in our own day, of course, those are not from our own day. Those are from ancient cultures, but perhaps not Canaanite cultures. The I Ching, especially from China, I believe it is. But those are also occultic means of divining. Astrology is a means of divining. He doesn't list it here, but in other places in the scripture, astrology is spoken of as a form of divination. There are Christians today who think it harmless to dabble with Ouija boards and the I Ching and astrology and other areas that are forbidden here. It's not a harmless thing. There are demonic powers here. In fact, although the Bible nowhere tells us exactly how persons become demon-possessed, you know, it describes people who are, but it doesn't ever say how they got that way. Yet, it would appear, at least from the experience of those that I've read of missionaries and others who've dealt with demon-possessed people, that it is most common among cultures where the occult is practiced. And it is the theory of most who have studied this, that is the area of demon possession. Though the Bible doesn't tell us plainly, it is apparent that demon possession is associated with the occult, and it's possible that people become possessed through involvement in the occult. We know that in Acts chapter 16, there was a fortune teller, a girl there. She had a spirit of Python, we're told, and she could tell fortunes. The Apostle Paul cast the demon out of her, and she could no longer tell fortunes. She lost her power. So she clearly had demonically inspired power. Now, whether she became demonized by getting involved in fortune telling, or whether she got the demon some other way and later discovered that she could tell fortunes, we aren't told. Likewise, Simon the sorcerer, who was obviously a sorcerer and involved in the occult, in Acts chapter 8, is said to have had supernatural powers that impressed people. And so, sorcery, divination, witchcraft, all of these things are forbidden, and if they do not cause a person to become demon-possessed, they exist because a person is demon-possessed. Unless the person is a total fake, in which case there's no value in consulting them anyway. Maybe less dangerous than consulting a demon, but it's not any really more helpful. Now, talking about the son or the daughter passing through the fire, there's no question about what that practice is. That has to do with the worship of Moloch, a god that apparently was depicted by a great bronze statue, that had the head of a goat and the body of a man. The man's arms were extended forward with the palms up from the elbows. And it was a hollow statue into which they built great fires until the statue glowed red hot. And a normal part of the Canaanite ritual was to place into the red hot bronze arms of this statue live babies, who were then, of course, burned and died very rapidly. This was called causing your son or your daughter to pass through the fire. Actually, it was not uncommon at all for pagan societies to sacrifice infants. The Canaanites were not the only ones. The Phoenicians did the same thing to Baal. The Incas and the Aztecs are known to have sacrificed humans. And the Druids of Western Europe were involved in human sacrifice and so forth.
Ever since Christianity has conquered the Western world for the most part, not to say that everyone there has become a Christian, but the culture has been changed, it seems strange to us. It seems like an unusual degree of depravity that a culture would offer sacrifice of human beings, and it is. But what we often are not in touch with is the fact that all cultures did this before the gospel came to them or before the law of Moses came to them. And even the Jews who had the law of Moses still, at many times in their history, lapsed into the worship of Moloch and did cause their children to pass through the fire. Manasseh, one of the kings of Judah, is said to have done this. And others are reported as doing so. So, I mean, it's an incredible thing that people could be so depraved that even with the law of God, but even if they did, you know, it's hard to imagine even without the law of God that anyone would be so deceived as to think that it could be right and good to offer their children to deities by killing their children or sacrificing them alive. And yet, that's the devil for you. I mean, the devil inspired all the false religions, and he apparently thrives on innocent blood. It's happening today, of course. We don't know to what extent it's happening. Some of the reports may be, exaggerated, but we do know there are human sacrifices being offered, and many of them are babies by Satanists. I don't know enough about witch covens to know how often it's done among witches.
I was thinking more of the millions of children who are killed by abortion.
Abortion is another way, sort of in a more abstract sort of sense, right? If we would understand Moloch to be the deity that inspires sensual pleasure, and by the way, it is known from what the archaeologists have found of Canaanite worship that the people, while they worship, while the baby burned in the arms of Moloch, people had an orgy in front of the statue. It was obviously not only the Canaanites, but all ancient pagan cultures tended to associate sensuality and sexual immorality with the worship of their deities, along with human sacrifice. I mean, the most perverse sorts of religion exist where there's been no revelation from God. Where there's no vision from God, the people perish. And before they perish, they fall into the most debauched forms of sensuous and cruel worship that human nature is capable of. And, it has been said that all the babies that are sacrificed in this country through abortion can be, in a sense, sacrificed in the same spirit as those sacrificed to Moloch, since the idea is a person who kills their baby, they obviously had sex for reasons other than procreation. They must have had sex for the mere pleasure of it, not intending to become pregnant. And when they found themselves pregnant, they sacrificed their baby to the pleasure principle or to their lifestyle of irresponsible sex, really. You see, God made sex to be at least potentially fruitful. It doesn't mean that every time people had sex, they were supposed to get pregnant. But it was always a possibility. God never intended for sex to be divorced from the concept of reproduction. And as soon as people divorce the concept of sex from reproduction, they do so usually in favor of just thinking of it entirely as a pleasurable experience and nothing more, just as an expression of sensual desire. And if they have fully divorced it from the concept of reproduction, then they sacrifice their babies, either through abortion or in Canaanite and other societies, they'd wait for the baby to be born and then sacrifice it. At any rate, it gave them the opportunity to have irresponsible sex without concern for a population explosion. Anyway, I think in principle there is a resemblance. Our culture is not really any better. Well, maybe a little better, but going down fast. Now, instead of the use of these diviners and spiritists and so forth, maybe I should tell you what some of these are. Some of them, there's a fine line between them, and they may even be synonyms for each other. For instance, there's reference to one who practices witchcraft, but in the same verse at the end, there's reference to a sorcerer. Sorcery and witchcraft are, whatever differences may be between them, I couldn't tell you. It's a fine line. It may be that they're synonymous, but maybe that in Moses' day, there were certain practices that were distinctly in the area of witchcraft and others that were distinctly in the area of sorcery. One who interprets omens refers to the common practice of divining through looking at the entrails of chickens or the entrails of goats. Sort of the same concept as reading tea leaves or something like that. Just the way they fall is supposed to be an omen of something or another, and the person who had the power to interpret them was involved in some kind of occultic practice. Soothsayer, and it's sort of like a fortune teller. In verse 11, one who conjures spells, we would consider that person to be in the category of witchcraft or sorcery. Again, there, it may have been overlapping one of those, or it may have had something more specific distinction. A medium or a spiritist. Now, again, in our society, we would use the word medium and spiritist for the same person. A spiritist or a medium is one who conducts a seance. Although it is possible that the medium would be the one who conducts the seance and the spiritist would be those who participate in it as spectators or, you know, clients. That is possible. A medium would clearly be the person who is in charge of the seance. A spiritist might be any participant in the seance, which is, of course, forbidden. And it says, one who calls up the dead. Again, there's not a serious difference between a spiritist and one who calls up the dead. But calling up the dead is technically called necromancy, which just means speaking to the dead. That is forbidden, as one of the Canaanite practices that are unworthy of God's people. He says in verse 12, they're an abomination to the Lord, and it's because of those very things that God is driving the Canaanites out, with the implication here, which is stated more plainly in Leviticus, that if the Israelites repeat those abominations, God will have no good reason to keep them in the land either. Elsewhere in Leviticus, God says the land is spewing these people out. It's vomiting these people out because of their abominations. And he says, and if you follow in their abominations, it'll vomit you out too. Then he says, in contrast, in verse 15, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me, that is like Moses, from your midst, from your brethren. Him you shall hear. Now instead of mediums, God will send other prophetic voices. Now some people understand this to be generic. God will send a prophet to any generation that needs a prophet, so that Isaiah would be the fulfillment of that, or Elijah would be the fulfillment of that, in different generations. Or, as you can see, the translators of our version that we're reading have capitalized it. That does not reflect a capitalization in the Hebrew. It's just the translator's opinion. But the translator is representing this prophet as Jesus, which we will see why in a moment. There's another reference in verse 18 that we'll consider. Anyway, whether it's referring to Jesus ultimately, and which seems to be, of course, the case, whether that excludes other prophets in the meantime who come before Jesus, I can't say. But essentially what God's saying is, when he wants to speak to me, but he'll speak through a prophet, not through an occultist. And you shall hear him, according to all you desired of the Lord your God in Horeb in the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, nor let me see this great fire any more, lest I die. And the Lord said to me, what they have spoken is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among your brethren, their brethren, and will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And it shall be that whoever will not hear my words, which he speaks in my name, I will require it of him. But the prophet who presumes to speak a word in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. And if you say in your heart, how shall we know the word which the Lord has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not happen nor come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously, you shall not be afraid of him. And in fact, he shall die, it says in verse 20. Now, it indicates that there will be prophets who are not genuine prophets. We are familiar from the New Testament with the idea of a false prophet. Interestingly, the expression false prophet is not found in the Old Testament. The New Testament refers to false prophets in a number of places. Jesus in the Olivet Discourse said, you know, beware of false prophets. They come to you wolves dressed like sheep. John says in 1 John 4, many false prophets have gone out into the world. And we'll find from time to time in the New Testament references to these false prophets. It says in 2 Peter 2:1, there were false prophets among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who privily shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord who brought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction. False prophets. But in the Old Testament, while we encounter false prophets, they're never called that. They're just called prophets. The prophets of Baal. Ahab's prophets. God had said in 1 Kings 22, it sent a lying spirit into the prophets of Baal. Obviously, these were false prophets. I mean, the prophets of Ahab. They were obviously false prophets, but the term false is not used for them.
Anybody who speaks and says, thus says the Lord, is a prophet. Whether he's a true prophet or a false prophet is to be determined by his message. But he is a prophet. I have a friend who says, anybody who claims to be an apostle is an apostle. But he may be a false one. There are false apostles mentioned in the scripture, and false and true apostles. There are false prophets and true prophets. There are false elders and true elders, Paul speaks of in Acts chapter 20. Any of the offices that are in leadership in the church have their counterparts in false ones, who are the counterfeits of the true. Now, God promises a prophet like Moses will come, but there will also be other prophets who are not true prophets. Well, what is not made plain here is there would also be other prophets that are true prophets prior to the coming of Jesus. And there were many of them. About 16 of them wrote books of our Bible, of our Old Testament. None of them had come at this time. So I think we can sort of read between the lines that God is saying, whenever I speak to my people, I'll send a prophet. And the way you'll know if a prophet is from me or not, one way at least, is by whether what he says comes to pass. If it doesn't, it's not me. Now, this is only a good test of true and false prophets in terms of the negative. If the prophecy does not come to pass, if the prediction does not come to pass, that person has distinguished himself as a false prophet. But what if the prophecy does come to pass? Does that establish him as a true prophet? Not necessarily. We already saw in chapter 13 that he says, if a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder which he gives you comes to pass, by which he says, let us go and worship other gods. He says, don't go after him. The Lord your God is testing you to see if you love the Lord your God with all your heart or not. So, a false prophet may even give a sign or wonder that comes to pass, or give a prediction that comes to pass. It does not prove him to be right. All we can say for sure is that if a prediction does not come true, that prophet is not spoken from God. If it does come true, then there's other tests that need to be applied. Like, what's the content of the message? Is it orthodox? Is it leading people away from the truth of God, away from God to other gods? If those things are true, then even if the prophecy prediction did come true, then the prophet is a false one. A false prophet is not necessarily known to be false because he says false predictions. He is false because he claims to be speaking from God and is not. Even if he makes true predictions, and even if he tells true doctrinal things, a false prophet can tell some truth. What makes him false is that he claims he's speaking from God and he isn't. And in Jeremiah frequently records God as saying, you know, these prophets spoke, but I didn't send them. They gave a word, but I didn't speak to them. And there are people who make it up out of their own heart, Jeremiah said. They prophesy out of their own heart. That is, out of their own mind, not from God's Spirit. Now, there is one prophet in particular in mind in verses 15 and 18. Verse 15 says, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me. In verse 18, God is speaking, I will raise up for them a prophet like you. The Jews came to understand that there was a particular prophet, par excellence, unlike any of the other prophets that came along after Moses. Unlike even Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel, those great prophets, one greater than that, one that could only be compared with Moses. If you look at the last verse in Deuteronomy, several verses, after it records the death of Moses, in chapter 34, verses 10 through 12, it says, but since then there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, in all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, before Pharaoh, before all his servants, and in all his land. And by all that mighty power and all that great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. The interesting thing here is that a prediction is made in chapter 18 that a prophet will arise like Moses, but at the time of the writing of this epilogue in the book, whoever wrote these closing verses about the death of Moses, whenever that person lived, it may have been Joshua or it may have been someone at a later date, he says, so far, that hasn't happened. So far, no prophet like Moses has appeared. And
the Jews began to develop a tradition about this. Some believed the prophet would be Jeremiah coming again. Not the Jeremiah who came the first time, well, maybe the same guy, but him coming back at the beginning of the Messianic Age. Others equated him with Elijah, partly strengthened by the fact that Malachi's closing words were that God would send Elijah the prophet before the coming terrible day of the Lord. And others just thought some unnamed mysterious prophet was going to appear who would be recognizable before the coming of the Messiah. When John the Baptist appeared, in John chapter 1 it says a group of religious leaders from Jerusalem came to ask him about his identity. The first thing they asked him was, "Are you the Messiah?" The question was on everybody's mind. Whenever an unusual religious leader came along, you know, well, maybe he's the Messiah. Is this the Messiah we're looking for? And they asked him about that, and he said, no. It says in verse 20, John 1:20, he confessed and did not deny, but confessed, "I'm not the Messiah, the Christ." Then they asked him, "What then, are you Elijah?" And he said, "I'm not." Then they said, "Are you the prophet?" And he answered, "No." The prophet. He didn't say, "Which prophet do you have in mind?" He knew exactly what prophet they meant. In his day, everyone was expecting the prophet. Moses had said, "God will raise up a prophet like me." And so far there had not yet come a prophet like Moses, of his stature. One who would be the national leader. The other prophets in the Old Testament were great men, but they never led the whole nation. They never were the leader of God's people. They never brought new legislation from God, as Moses had, but Jesus did. And what the Christians later realized was that that prophet was the same as the Messiah. You see, the questioning that the Jews gave to John the Baptist makes it clear, it wasn't clear in their mind. Is the Messiah the same person as his prophet? Apparently they weren't sure that he was. Because when he says, "No, I'm not the Messiah," they later said, "Well, how about, are you the prophet?" To the Jews, it was not clear at all. Would this prophet be someone other than the Messiah? But the early Christians realized that this prophet was none other than the Messiah. If you look at Acts chapter 3, this is Peter preaching his second recorded sermon. Verse 20 and following. "And that he may send Jesus Christ," that is in the second coming, "who was preached to you before, whom the heaven must receive, until the times of the restoration of all things, which God has spoken by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began. For Moses truly said to the fathers, 'The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. Him you shall hear in all things, whatever he says to you.' And it shall come to pass that every soul who will not hear that prophet shall be utterly destroyed from among the people." Look at chapter 7 of Acts in verse 37. Acts 7 is Stephen's sermon. And it says in verse 37, "This is that Moses who said to the children of Israel, 'The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your brethren. Him you shall hear.' This is he who was with the congregation in the wilderness," that is Moses was, "with the angel who spoke with him on Mount Sinai," and so forth. Then it goes on to identify, of course, Jesus as the one who was promised. Because he says in verse 51, later in the sermon, "You stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit as your fathers did, so do you. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers." You know, quite clearly, he's referring to their betrayal of Jesus. Peter and Stephen, and no doubt the Christians in general, understood that that prophet Moses anticipated was none other than the Messiah, Jesus himself. Now, one thing of great interest is that when Peter quotes it in Acts chapter 3, and verse 23, the latter part of his quote, Acts 3:23, he says, "And it shall come to pass that every soul who does not hear that prophet," meaning Jesus, "whoever does not receive Jesus, shall be utterly destroyed from among the people." Peter understands this prophecy of Moses to say that when the Messiah comes, when Jesus comes, Those who receive him will be saved, but those who don't hearken to him, will be destroyed. Now, the way it reads in actually in Deuteronomy, in the Hebrew, which ours is translated from, Deuteronomy 18:19 says, "And it shall be that whoever will not hear my words which he speaks," that is that prophet Jesus speaks in my name, "I will require it of him." I will require it of him. An interesting statement. It means, of course, that God will get his pound of flesh out of that person. God will judge them. He'll make them pay the whole price that is due. On that expression, God will require it of him. Look over at Matthew chapter 23. Oh, now I'm on a tangent and I won't get very far in Deuteronomy. But anyway.
Just say no.
Well, let's look at this anyway. Matthew 23. It says, so where do we want to start? Verse 31. "Therefore you are the witnesses against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt," meaning by go ahead and kill Jesus too. Might as well fill the cup of wrath. "Serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of hell?" Yes, down to verse 35. "That on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." Obviously referring to the judgment that came upon them in 70 AD. "All these things will come upon this generation." Now, the reason I turn you here is because he refers to Zechariah, whom you slew between the temple and the altar. If you'll turn to the story he's referring to in 2 Chronicles. Now, there's a bit of a problem with whose son Zechariah is. We'll deal with that on another occasion. But in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, the prophet that Jesus is referring to here is stoned to death by his own cousin, the king, and his emissaries. 2 Chronicles 24:20 says, "Then the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah the son of Jehoiada." There's the problem with the father of that guy, but that's another problem for another time. "Who stood above the people and said to them, 'Thus says God, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord so that you cannot prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he also has forsaken you.' So they conspired against him, and at the commandment of the king, they stoned him with stones in the court of the house of the Lord. Thus Joash, the king, did not remember the kindness of Jehoiada, his father, that he had done to him, but killed his son. And as he died, he said," Zechariah, when he died, said, "'The Lord look upon it and repay.'" Anyone have the King James Version? Does it read the same way at the end of verse 22 in the King James Version? "The Lord will require it," he said. Now, it says, put this all together. In Deuteronomy 18, it says, anyone who doesn't listen to that prophet, the Lord will require it. Peter quotes the Deuteronomy passage and says, anyone who doesn't listen to that prophet will be destroyed utterly. He's referring to 70 AD. That's when God required it. Jesus said, the blood of all the martyrs who were righteous Abel to Zechariah will come upon this generation. Speaking of Zechariah, he said, the Lord is going to require it, require this blood. The idea of God requiring it, that is, requiring the repayment for the righteous blood that they shed, is fulfilled in 70 AD. And Jesus said, it's all going to come on this generation. So, what is referred to here, somewhat veiledly, in Deuteronomy 18, is that God is going to send the Messiah. And the true Israel would hearken to him. The true Israel would listen to Jesus and would become Christians, and they did. But anyone who would not listen to him, God would require it. And that has to do with the threat of the judgment that actually occurred upon the Jews who rejected Christ 40 years afterwards in 70 AD. The Lord required it of that generation. Anyway, maybe a little bit too complex and too time-consuming. We need to go on to chapter 19. In chapter 19, there's not too much I need to add new because the material there was covered, or at least the first 13 verses of chapter 19, is covered in detail also in Numbers 35, which we covered last week. Numbers 35, verses 9 through 28, talk about the need for three cities of refuge on the east of the Jordan and three on the west of the Jordan. Likewise here. In Deuteronomy 4, verses 41 through 43, it named the three cities on the east of the Jordan, but it did not mention what cities would be on the west side of the Jordan. Deuteronomy 4, 41 through 43, gave us those three on the east. But Numbers had already mentioned that there would be three more on the other side. Likewise, here in chapter 19, verse 2, it says, "You shall separate three cities for yourself in the midst of your land, which the Lord your God has given you to possess." That is on the west side of the Jordan. So he tells them to separate three cities on the west side of the Jordan now. That'd be make total six. But later, he says in verse 8, "Now if the Lord your God enlarges your territory, as he swore to your fathers, and gives you the land which he promised to give your fathers, and if you keep all these commandments and do them, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to walk in his ways always, then you shall add three more cities," apparently making a total of nine, "for yourselves besides these three." Now this is a new development. Numbers chapter 35 talked about there being six cities of refuge. Deuteronomy chapter 4 talked about three on the east side of Jordan. And now this chapter in verse 2 talks about three on the west side of Jordan. And in verse 9 it seems to suggest there being at least a provision made for three more, and that is a total of nine, if the city, if the territory was enlarged and so forth. So the names of those cities are not given here, however. The cities of refuge, of course we know what they're for. It's for the person who accidentally kills somebody. An accidental murder. In which case they could flee to the city of refuge, and if they were truly innocent, they would be preserved. They wouldn't be killed. They wouldn't be executed for the crime. If they were not innocent, though, they would be excluded from the city of refuge, and they would be put to death by the avenger of blood. We know the story, I'm sure, from our previous studies and Numbers. We'll go on now to verse 14, which actually is not new. It is new here, but it's mentioned in other places later. "You shall not remove your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set in your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land of the Lord Lord your God has given you to possess." Moving the landmark is simply a way of thieving. They didn't have high-tech ways of surveying real estate in those days. And so, in the days of Joshua, he allotted certain family portions of the land, which were to be passed down in perpetuity to the same family, and never to pass from one family to the next, or at least not from one tribe to the next, permanently anyway. And so they'd have these landmarks that were established probably in the days of Joshua. But if somebody would move one of those landmarks, that is, if he comes to a landmark that's at the edge of his property and moved it over, you know, a few hundred yards, so as to extend his property at the expense of his next door neighbor, it might not be easily discovered that he'd done so, since surveying the property wouldn't be, you know, as easy a matter as it would be with today's equipment for such purposes. And it's basically, or if he moved it over a few yards so it was imperceptible, or even a little at a time, he could be expanding his property at the expense of his neighbor. That is, stealing property from his neighbor. That's what's forbidden here. Don't steal your neighbor's property. It's also, a curse is pronounced on the person who does this. In Deuteronomy 27, verse 17, it says, "Cursed is everyone who moves the landmark of his inheritance." Deuteronomy 27:17. Now, if I had time to, you know, wax homiletic and preach on this, I'd probably want to spiritualize it and talk about the curse that should come on anyone who changes the borders or the description of the inheritance that God has given. That is, we have a spiritual inheritance. The physical land that was given to them as an inheritance was a type of the spiritual inheritance of the Christian. And, of course, those who define the boundaries of that inheritance would be those who communicate the gospel or who teach or preach. And to change the borders. For example, to make a greasy grace sort of gospel that allows, you know, people to consider themselves in who are not really in as far as God is concerned. Or to make it more restrictive, more legalistic, so that those who really are in feel like they're not allowed in. Any alteration of the definition of the gospel and of the inheritance that God has for us would be something that would be offensive to God. And, of course, that's a slightly different twist than what is intended by Moses here. Verse 15, we have the law concerning witnesses. It says, "One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commit, by the mouth of two or three witnesses the matter shall be established. We encountered this a few chapters back already. If a false witness arises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priest and the judges who serve in those days, and the judges shall make diligent inquiry indeed if the witness is a false witness. That is, if they can't find a second witness to establish and corroborate his story, who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother.
An evil person from among you, and those who remain shall hear and fear, and hereafter they shall not again commit such evil among you. Your eye shall not pity, but life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Which is simply a means of discouraging people from making false accusations. Whatever you hoped would happen to him by making a false accusation against your brother is what you would have to get back to you. An example of this would be when accusations were brought against Daniel so that he was put in the lion's den. When God vindicated him, his very accusers were thrown in the lion's den and were eaten by the lions. Or in the story of Esther, a notable case, when Haman... Send out our big guns. When Haman built a gallows to hang Mordecai on, as we see, as God turned things around, Mordecai was spared because he was innocent, but Haman, who was bringing false charges against him, was hanged on the gallows. So it says in Proverbs chapter 19, he that digs a pit shall fall in it, assuming that you're digging it to catch someone else, and he that rolls a stone, it'll roll back on him. It says that over in Proverbs 19, verses 5. And 19 indicates that God will bring retribution upon someone who wrongly seeks to trap or hurt someone else. And here, the law is, if you get caught bearing false witness, then the penalty for the crime you accused them of is the penalty you can expect on yourself, including capital crimes. A life for life, hand for hand, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. If the penalty for what you're accusing the person of is for that person to be put to death or to lose an eye or a hand, then that's what happens to you, the false accuser. Okay. Maybe that's why the devil's going to hell.
That's right.
That's exactly what he's trying to get us to do by bringing accusations against us. Chapter 20. Now, this is an interesting chapter. It has to do with the ethics of warfare. Now, you know my views on warfare, I think. I personally believe that some wars are just. And some wars are not just. But whether a war be just or not, or more or less just, I don't think Christians are called to participate in it. I think God uses wars to cause the rise and the fall of kingdoms. God is sovereign over the nations. The Bible says he raises up one king and brings down another. It says that he sets upon the thrones of the kingdoms of the world whoever he wants. Usually that's through the process of war or a coup or something. But though God is the one who ultimately ordains the outcome of things, not all the means of getting them done are good means. For example, many kings have risen by treachery, or by lying, or by murder. Others have come to power and gained dominion by war. The fact that God is the one who allows them to rise or prevents them from it doesn't mean he approves of all the means that they use to do it. Just like we know that God was sovereignly in the purpose of having Jesus crucified, that doesn't mean he approved of Judas Iscariot being a schmuck, or of the priests who hired false witnesses to condemn him. Obviously, they're answerable for their crimes. We can't say that just because the end was something God approved, that the means was approved also. The end does not justify the means. God may use the evil of men. It says in a certain place, I say that because I don't know the place, but I don't feel too bad about that because the writer of Hebrews does the same thing. As it is written in a certain place. What does it say in that place, after all? It says I forgot what I was going to say. I forgot where it is, too. So I can't even look there to find out what it says. But it'll come back to me. I know it. I'm a little scatterbrained today, but as I start rapping on this, it'll come back and say, oh, yeah, that's it. Okay. On the subject of the ethics of war, the fact that God allows war... Okay, I do remember the passage I was thinking of. I still don't remember the reference. It says God will restrain the wrath of man that he can't use. It actually says the wrath, it's in the Psalms, the wrath of man shall he shall cause to praise him, and the residue of the wrath he shall restrain. Which means he can use the wrath of man for his purposes, and if he can't, he won't let man even conduct it. Now, it's interesting that the Psalm says that God can cause the wrath of man to praise him, because in James it says the wrath of man does not work the righteousness of God. How do we harmonize those two things? Simply this way. God in his sovereignty can use anything, even things he doesn't approve of. As far as the Christian is concerned, though, we should not participate in the wrath of man, because that is not God's preferred way of working his righteousness. God's way of working righteousness is not, at least as far as his people are concerned, through wrath of man. Now, when man is wrathful against God's will, God can use it. He can turn it to his purposes. But the Christian does not participate in that means. We can say, okay, I can see God used it. God used Desert Storm. God used World War I and World War II. God used the Six-Day War in Israel. God uses these things, and he brings about results that he wants to see brought about. But that doesn't mean that everything that was done to accomplish those results were something God approved of. And so, where I stand on this, especially based on Jesus' teachings about love for your enemy and about justice and so forth, is that Christians, though we can acknowledge God's use of wars and his sovereignty, we don't necessarily feel that as a Christian, loving our enemies is compatible with killing them. Now, on the other hand, there are Christians who take a different view than mine, who say, well, we are entitled to fight in some wars. Christians shouldn't fight in every war, but they should fight in just wars. And a just war has certain criteria attached. Now, before I talk about the just war criteria, I was in church just last Sunday in a Sunday school class, and the guy was talking about war, and he was saying Christians should fight in wars. And he said, he was talking about Romans 13. And he said, now God has ordained all authorities, even Saddam Hussein, even Adolf Hitler, and so forth. And then he went on to say, since God has ordained authorities, you should obey authorities, including fighting in war if they tell you to fight in war. I said, excuse me a minute. You just told me from Romans 13 that Saddam Hussein was an authority set up by God, and that whoever resists the authority resists God. Yet if I was drafted into the American military to go fight Saddam Hussein, would I not be resisting God then? By submitting to that, since Saddam Hussein is ordained by God, you said? And that whoever resists the authority, as Paul says in Romans 13, is resisting God. If I go and resist a legitimate authority, Saddam Hussein, am I not resisting God? How then shall I fight war? And then, you know, he would say, well, you only have to submit to the authorities of your own country. I said, well, then that follows that a Christian in Iraq would be required by God to participate in Saddam's army fighting against us Christians over here. He said, that's right. Now, he quickly led the discussion in another direction, and I wanted to pursue that more, because, of course, if I had been able to pursue it, I would point out, that would mean, of course, then, that if I was in Hitler's army, and he told me to do things that I would not ordinarily do, but simply because I was told by authorities to do it, I should put Jews in the oven. I mean, where do you draw the line and say, I will not allow the authorities to tell me what to do when it goes against my conscience before God? Where would you draw the line? Now, he would, of course, say, in fact, that Sunday school teacher himself said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did the right thing not to obey, not to bow down to an idol. Daniel did the right thing not to submit to Darius's decree, because we cannot obey authorities when it's disobeying God to do so. But then apparently he doesn't think that killing civilians is disobeying God, if the authorities tell you to do it. But if it would be wrong to kill authorities, as to kill civilians when no authority has told you to do it, then is it not morally wrong to kill civilians? Then if an authority tells you to do it, isn't he telling you to do something that's sin? To kill a civilian? To bomb a city where there's women and children who have no interest in the war whatsoever, they just want to survive? Christians aren't thinking straight when they say it's okay to go to war. They're just not thinking like Christians, they're thinking like patriots. And Christianity and nationalism are mutually exclusive, biblically speaking. The Church of Jesus Christ is not a national entity. There is no Jew or Gentile, barbarian, Scythian, bond or free. There are no national ethnic distinctions that are to be recognized in Christianity. You see, if I go and fight against Russia, I may be fighting against Christian brothers over there. And for whom am I fighting? Largely a pagan country over here. So I may be killing Christians in order to defend pagans. I don't really understand the ethics of that. It certainly confused me about where my identity is. My identity in being an American, or is it in being a Christian? A member of the Church of Jesus Christ. If it's in being a Christian, as it certainly is supposed to be, then I'm supposed to be a witness to the world by my love for the brethren, by my unity with the brethren. How muddled does that testimony become when I'm shooting at them across the battlefield? Obviously, there is... I mean, anyone who thinks carefully and without the taint of carnal patriotism, and I'm not saying that all patriotism is carnal, but I think patriotism tends toward idolatry, that person can see that the teachings of Jesus cannot be harmonized with going to war. One nation against another. And Paul himself said it plainly in a couple of places. He says, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. We wrestle against principalities and powers and the rulers of the darkness of sin, spiritual wickedness in high places, not with humans. That's not our warfare. That's someone else's problem, not ours. Christians aren't involved. And for 300 years after the time of Christ, no Christian would participate. All the church fathers agreed warfare was not for Christians. And they argued exactly the same way I am, although I didn't realize they did until recently. I've read some of their writings, and I was pleased to see they said the same things I did about it. But that's not what makes it true. It's the fact that Jesus and Paul said it that tell us it's true. Paul said elsewhere in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, the weapons of our warfare are not physical. The stress on our warfare. There's more than one kind of warfare. The world has its warfare, but we have ours. Ours is not physical. Ours is not the use of physical weapons. Our weapons are mighty through God.
Right.
To pulling down strongholds and casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God and bringing every thought into the captivity of Jesus Christ. Do you know of any physical weapon that can do any of those things? Do you know of any physical weapon which can cause a man's thoughts to be brought in captivity? Only spiritual weapons can do that. And we waste our time trying to change the world through physical weapons. That just doesn't work. People's hearts are not won that way. Now, Jesus, when he was interviewed by Pilate in John chapter 18, he said, Pilate, are you king then? And Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were of this world, my servants would have fought so that I should not be taken captive by the Jews. But now, my kingdom is not from here. Now, that's an interesting statement. Jesus said, my servants don't fight because they're citizens of my kingdom, and my kingdom is not of this world. Therefore, there's no worldly boundaries to defend. There's no worldly boundaries. How can you defend the territory? Where is it? It's spiritual territory. You can only defend it through spiritual warfare. There is no piece of geography, there's no piece of real estate that belongs to the Christians that they should defend. My kingdom is not of this world. Therefore, my servants don't fight. He says, actually, the way he put it is, or else my servants would have fought. And in saying that, Jesus seemed to imply that those whose kingdom is of this world ought to fight to defend their borders. I mean, if that's the only kingdom they've got, might as well support it. Might as well defend it. Jesus implied in his statement that if his kingdom had been of this world, then his servants would fight, like other servants of other kingdoms of this world do. But he says, because my kingdom is not of this world, my servants don't do it. That's in John chapter 18. Probably you like that verse. What is it?
36,
thanks. John 18, 36. So, what I understand to be the teaching of Scripture is that until you're a Christian, you are an American or a Canadian or a German or an Australian or a Russian or a Chinese or something like that. When you become a Christian, you die. And you're born again into a different kingdom with different citizenship. And that's the kingdom of God. Paul said in Colossians 1:13, God has translated us out of the power of darkness into the kingdom of his own dear Son. And that's a global entity. I mean, there's people from all over the world in that. And it's a spiritual kingdom, and it's defended by spiritual means. There's no physical territory to defend. Now, the reason I say all that is because the Jews fought in wars with God's sanction and God's command. And this is often brought up as a proof that Christians ought to do the same, but there's no parallel here. The Jews had territory. They had a kingdom of this world. Sure, they were God's people, but they also were a political nation. When they fought in wars, God told them when to and when not to, by the way. And when they fought, it was very clear who the bad guys were. The people who were Israel were God's nation. The people outside were not. We don't have any clear-cut national issues like that today. There's no nation that is God's nation today. Certainly America isn't, and America's trying very hard to prove it. And, you know, we just tend to see our own nation through rose-colored glasses. But if God looks at our nation, I don't think he sees us as more Christian than Russia. If anything, Russia is more Christian than we are. They're bringing the gospel into the public schools there. They're calling in the missionaries to come and speak to their kids and to their college campuses. This culture is trying to exclude the gospel from all those arenas. I really, you know, just because it's our country doesn't mean it's better. That's the problem with patriotism and nationalism. I don't say there's anything wrong with being thankful to God that you're an American. I believe this is the best place in the world to live. Of any place I've ever seen, it's the best place to live. I thank God for that. I'm thankful that I'm an American. If you're Canadian, you can be thankful you're Canadian instead of something else. But patriotism's different. Thankfulness means you're still honoring God, tops, and you see being American is one of the blessings he's given. It's like thanking him that you have a house to live in, or a car to drive, or food in your stomach. It's just one of the many, temporal blessings that have come. But patriotism is when you begin to think that your nation is better than other nations for no other reason than it's yours. It's just out of touch with reality. It's quite obvious that every nation, every army that fought in any war for any nation, thought their nation was the best. Why? Just because it was theirs. There's no objectivity in that. There's no truth in that. There's no reality in it. It's just a subjective loyalty, blind loyalty to one's own country. Christians are supposed to be delivered from such blindness and look at issues the way God does. Now, the Jews were God's nation. God gave them territory. He said, there's going to be people who want to fight over this territory. For one thing, the people who are already there. You're going to have to get rid of them. And then there's going to be others who you'll fight against in the future as you expand your territory. What I want you to do is fight these people. I want you to defend your territory. And I want you to expand it by war. By the way, whenever God did send the Israelites into war, it was as a judgment against the other nations. You might say, well, maybe God would use America to bring judgment on Saddam Hussein. I agree. The question is, how do we know that? When I get drafted by the American military, which I won't, I'm too old now. Besides, I was a conscientious objector when I was young enough. But if I were drafted into the American military to go fight Saddam Hussein, I might say, well, it seems like we're a more righteous nation than Saddam's nation. But are we? We've had more opportunity. They haven't even had the gospel there yet, hardly. We have, and we've rejected it. Maybe God sees us as worse than them. How do I know God wants to use our nation to bring judgment on them? Maybe he wants to use their nation to bring judgment on us. When the Babylonians were coming against Jerusalem, Habakkuk the prophet said, God, how can you give these Babylonians power over us? We're your people. We're a more righteous nation than they are. And God said, hey, they deserve to die. You deserve to die. I'll use them to kill you first, and then I'll judge them later. Just because your nation is more righteous doesn't mean you're going to be the last to go down. You see, how can we ever determine in any conflict between nations which side God is on? Unless, of course, some nation has a prophet of God, like Isaiah, saying, yes, go to battle, or no, don't go to battle, or like Moses saying, yes, go exterminate these people, or don't. I mean, if you've got a prophet of God, then you've got a pretty good idea. But who does? What nation is there on the face of the earth like Israel who got their orders, military commands, straight from God? I know of none. Therefore, I know of no parallels in modern wars to the wars that we read of here. Now, the Jews were not supposed to conduct themselves cruelly in war, although sometimes they were supposed to be quite comprehensive in their destruction. They were not to be, you know, insanely cruel like some of the Assyrians or the Babylonians were known to be in their warfare. And chapter 20 basically is to govern the ethics of warfare. Now, it's very clear that up through verse 14, this has to do with not the Canaanite warfare, not war against Canaanites. This is talking about later warfares. He makes it clear in verse 15. He says, thus you shall do to all the cities which are very far from you, which are not the cities of these nations, but the cities of these peoples you are to exterminate, he says. So he's already made that clear. He reiterates it in verses 16 through 18. When they go to Canaan, they're not supposed to leave anything alive that breathes. But in verses 1 through 14, he talks about other wars. After they're settled in, after the Canaanites are subdued, and they are on other military missions, there are certain things they're supposed to do. Now, today, as I said, there are Christians who say, well, Christians, yeah, we shouldn't fight in every war, but we should be willing to fight in a just war. Well, what is a just war? The concept of a just war came not from Christianity, nor from Judaism, but from Plato, from the Greek thought. Plato was the first to line out what he called the just war guidelines. A war could be considered just if it was defensive merely, not aggressive, if it was conducted with limited means, if the immunity of non-combatants was guaranteed, if it was not fought for political expansion, but merely for self-defense of the nation. And there were several other guidelines. Well, this was right out of paganism. I mean, it's a nice idea, but it's not from God's revealed word. Plato came up with it, and later, Augustine, a Christian theologian in the early 4th century, worked out Plato's guidelines and sort of Christianized them, and he came up with the just war guidelines for Christians. By the way, before Augustine, Christians had never, they'd always refused to fight the military, and that was for 3 centuries after Christ. Christians knew that military involvement was not part of Christian attitude. However, Augustine lived in the days of Constantine. Constantine was the first Christian emperor. And when the emperor became Christian, suddenly the empire was Christian. And then all the wars became holy wars. Any war that was in favor of the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, was one of God's wars. Now, the Christians had to decide, okay, what's the ethics of us fighting in wars now? They knew before that you never fight in wars. When Constantine and Augustine began to shape the theology of the church in the 4th century, Augustine borrowed from Plato to get these guidelines for just war. Later, St. Thomas Aquinas, in the Middle Ages, developed these more. Today, almost every Christian writer on the subject of war, and I have a large library full of books I buy of modern writers writing about war from a Christian viewpoint, almost all of them support involvement in a just war. They lay out the same guidelines. Non-combatant immunity. No aggression. It has to be it can't even be retaliation. It must be just defensive. It has to be limited force. And so forth. Well, they lay out the guidelines, and in saying, yes, of course Christians should not fight in an unjust war, but only in a just war, essentially what they're saying is Christians shouldn't fight in any war. Now, they don't say it like that because they think that every war that our country's been in has been a just one. But when you look at the just war guidelines that are laid out, there's never been a war like that. There's never been a war where non-combatants have been immune from terror and from death. And certainly, there have not been very many wars. Desert Storm was an exception. But there haven't been very many wars where limited force was used. I think the United Nations forces showed commendable restraint in Desert Storm. They didn't use nuclear weapons, for example. But in World War II, we used nuclear weapons. And some might say, well, that was warranted. Because, I mean, if we hadn't used that, then the Japanese and the Germans would have, swallowed up the world. And after all, it was the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima that caused the Japanese to surrender. True. But couldn't we have shown them what we could do by dropping that bomb in an unpopulated area? Wouldn't it have scared them just as much to see what we could do without wiping out a whole huge city of civilians? That is not what we call just war. The firebombing of Dresden in Germany was not following the just war guidelines. Our wars of our nation have not been what even the pagans regarded as just wars, in which Christians have bought into, and almost all modern Christian thinkers on the subject agree with. Well, of course, Christian leaders are always, in order to mix their approval of fighting in war with Scripture, they try to find some scriptural justification for the so-called just war guidelines. This is the chapter they always appeal to. They always appeal to Deuteronomy 20. Because here they say, now see, here's where the just war guidelines come from. Wrong. Just war guidelines come from Plato. There's nothing like just war guidelines here. This is the opposite of the just war theory. Let me read to you the first 14 verses and you'll see what I mean. We actually don't get to the guidelines until you get to verse 10. But we'll read this chapter. When you go out to battle and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. So it shall be when you are on the verge of battle that the priest shall approach and speak to the people, and he shall say to them, Hear, O Israel, today you are on the verge of battle with your enemies. Do not let your heart faint, do not be afraid, and do not tremble or be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you and against your enemies to save you. Now, according to verse 15, we now know that we're reading about wars other than the wars against the Canaanites. These would be later wars in their history. First thing they're supposed to do is encouraged by the priest and say, God's with you. Don't be afraid. They're a big army you're coming against, but God's bigger than they are. Don't be afraid of them. Go for it. And then, in verses 5 through 9, they thin out the ranks. Reminds us a little bit of the story of Gideon, unless you haven't read the story of Gideon yet. It comes up in the book of Judges. But in verse 5 it says, "Then the officers shall speak to the people, saying, what man is there who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go home and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. And what man is there who has planted a vineyard and has not yet eaten of it? Let him also go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man eat it. And what man is there who is betrothed to a woman who has not yet married her? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man marry her. Then the officer shall speak further to the people and say, what man is there who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest his heart, the heart of his brethren, faint like his heart." Now he inspires fear in his compatriots. "And so it shall be, when the officers have finished speaking to the people, that they shall make captains of armies and lead the people." Okay, before they go on to the battle against their enemies, they thin the ranks. Anyone who might be distracted or fearful is not allowed to go. Did you build a house and then your draft notice appeared and you didn't even get a chance to move in? Or plant a vineyard and before the harvest vintage came, you got your draft notice and had to leave? Or you betrothed a wife and before you could actually marry her, you got drafted? Well, listen, you're going to be distracted. We need people who are wholly into this thing. You're going to, half your heart's going to be back home with your vineyard or your beloved or your house. Go on home. We only want people who are wholehearted here. That's certainly what Gideon was told to do. Gideon had many thousands of people gathered initially to his first summons to battle, and then God had him trim them down to about 300 altogether, and then he won with that crew. Because some of the ones that he sent away were faint-hearted. He said, anyone afraid, go home. They left. It's quite clear that Israel, in such battles as these, was supposed to have a volunteer army. Because anyone who simply didn't want to be there was told to go home. Anyone who had anything that was more important to him than the battle, or was afraid, was just to go home. And so, if we were hoping to guide our own nation's military policy by this chapter, then, which of course we can't, because our nation is not parallel to Israel. Our nation does not have the same status in God's economy as Israel had in this case. But if we wish to do it, we'd have to, of course, insist on a volunteer army, which we now have. When I was a kid, it was a draft. And in fact, they dropped the draft just the year I would have been drafted, which was... Obviously, it's nice to see God changing the whole national policy for my sake. But anyway, I would have gone to Vietnam otherwise. Well, I would have not. I would have gone to jail because I was a conscientious objector. If they didn't give me my conscientious objector status, I would have gone to jail, not Vietnam. But anyway, they dropped the draft, so that problem didn't arise. But here, Israel is to have a volunteer army made up of only those people who were really zealous to go out and fight the Lord's battles for him. Then we come to the part where the supposed just war guidelines are drawn from. That's verses 10 through 14. When you go near to a city to fight against it, then proclaim an offer of peace to it. And it shall be that if they accept your offer of peace and open to you, then all the people who are found in it shall be placed under tribute to you and serve you. Now, if the city will not make peace with you, but would make war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when the Lord your God delivers it into your hands, you shall strike every male in it with the edge of the sword. But the women, the little ones, the livestock, and all that is in the city, all of its spoil, you shall plunder for yourself, and you shall eat the enemy's plunder, which the Lord your God gives you. Now again, this is only non-Canaanite cities, because they're not even supposed to leave the women and children alive in the Canaanite cities. Now, does that sound like just war guidelines to you? They come up against a city that is minding their own business. This is not a defensive war, this is an aggressive war, it's an act of aggression. They offer terms of peace. Well, that sounds certainly good intention. What are the terms of peace? The city has to surrender and pay tribute to you. So you've got, I mean, again, that would not be agreeable with just war guidelines. The just war guidelines suggest you don't get involved in war unless you are attacked, and you only fight those soldiers who are coming against you. There's no similarity here. Israel is initiating the war. They're going against someone who's not even picking on them, and they're insisting that they surrender or die. If they surrender, they have it easy. They only have to pay tribute to Israel. But if they don't surrender, they go in and what? Kill every male, including children. Now, male children. You keep only the women, female folk, for yourself. Now, that doesn't sound very much like what I read in the Just War books. In the Just War books, there's supposed to be non-combatant immunity. And we certainly would think that old, aged men who would be put to death under this policy would not be combatants, nor young boys. And even the women who are spared alive are not exactly left immune. They're taken as slaves. So it's totally invalid to use this chapter to support the so-called just war theory. However, it is always appealed to because it's the only thing in the Bible that people can think of that seems to regulate warfare, apart from the old, you know, jihad kind of warfare where they wipe out everything that breathes. This is moderate warfare for the Jews. You only kill all the men. That's moderate for them. Well, that's not, of course, just war theory. So the just war theory originates entirely from outside the Bible. And while it sounds good philosophically, hey, Plato was a smart philosopher, but it isn't necessarily a reflection of God's teaching on the subject in the Scripture. In fact, it seems to go against it, as near as I can understand it. Now, I would just make a comment. It says in verse 14, you can take their women and their little ones for yourself. Some people have tried to make it sound like, you know, you just use these women for sex partners or something like that. Actually, that's not necessarily implied. When we get to chapter 21, verses 10 through 14, it talks about what you do with these women. In fact, we might as well just look ahead for the moment since it really fits in this context. Chapter 21, 10 through 14. When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hand, and you take them captive. Clearly, this is not the Canaanite battle. This is not the conquest of Canaan, because they're not going to keep any of their captives alive in that. And you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and desire her that you want to take her for your wife. Then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails, apparently to fully cut off, a symbol of cutting off her entire past life as a Canaanite, or not a Canaanite, but as a heathen. She shall put off her clothes of her captivity and remain in your house and mourn for her father and her mother a full month. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. So this is talking about not raping these women or taking them as slave sex partners, as some pagan society would do. The Jew who took these women captive was entitled to marry them. But even so, he didn't treat them like a slave. He had to be sensitive. Listen, the woman's sad. She just lost her father and mother in the battle. Give her a while to grieve before you go into her, before you marry her. And of course, a month later, she's not likely to love you a whole lot for killing her mom and dad, but she might have partially gotten over it by then. Not likely. But at least you give her a little time to sort it out. Remember, people didn't always marry for love in those days. In verse 14, it says, and it shall be, if you have no delight in her, then you shall set her free. But you certainly shall not sell her for money, for you shall not treat her brutally, because you have humbled her. Now, this may seem strange to our culture, with our Christian ideas, which are, of course, far more enlightened than what God gave these people here in the Old Testament times. We realize, of course, you know, this is not really a very nice thing to do to a woman. But when you compare it with what the other cultures were doing, it's incredibly kind in view of the fact that he's not allowed to treat her brutally, which in those days, cultures allowed people to treat their slaves brutally. He says, you can't treat her brutally. If you don't like her, you can't sell her for money. You can't just treat her like a piece of property. You slept with her, she's your wife, you can divorce her if you want to, but you can't sell her like a piece of property. And, you know, it's sort of a halfway between the morals that we would acknowledge from our more enlightened New Testament vantage point and the morals that were more corrupt of the heathen around them. You know, the law kind of regulated this kind of behavior. It's obviously not the ideal, but it does restrain them some in their abuse of their captives. Okay, verses 15, we're chapter 20, verses 15 through 18, just repeat again what we've read many times, namely that they're not supposed to leave any living people of the Canaanites, but that these instructions in verses 10 through 14 only apply to non-Canaanite peoples and non-Canaanite cities. Verses 19 and 20 says, when you besiege a city for a long time, while making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. If you can eat of them, do not cut them down because there's spotted owls in them. And they don't grow in new growth. If you can eat the owls, if you can eat from the trees, do not cut them down to use them in the siege, for the tree of the field is a man's food. Only the trees which you know are not trees for food, you may destroy and cut down to build siege works against the city to make war with you until it is subdued. Now, it was not uncommon in ancient warfare, since they had to get over the wall. These cities had big walls around them. How does an army get over the walls to invade a city? They have to cut down the neighboring trees and build these big rolling, platforms that they'd roll up to the wall, and then they'd go climbing over the platforms over the wall. These are called siege works. And he says, now when you make siege works, make sure you only cut down trees that are not fruit trees or not trees that you can eat from. Don't be indiscriminate. Don't be stupid. After all, you're taking over this territory. You'll need the fruit trees that are of value to you. And even the survivors of this siege, who are not your own people, you've got to consider, they get their food from these trees. Don't eliminate the trees. Now, when the Romans besieged Jerusalem in 70 AD, Josephus tells us that they denuded the entire place of trees. Josephus describes places that had previously been forests, where he says, now there wasn't a tree to be seen. Because in the battle against Jerusalem, in the siege against Jerusalem, the Romans used all the surrounding trees for siege works. This is the kind of thing that the Jews were not permitted to do when they besieged a city. They were supposed to leave any tree that might be good for food in the future. It takes a long time to grow a tree, and it's a main source of fruit and so forth. So don't be so eager to get the battle over with that you indiscriminately cut down trees that you'll later regret having cut down. Chapter 21. If anyone is found slain lying in the field in the land which the Lord your God has given you to possess, and it is not known who killed him, then your elders and your judges shall go out, and they shall measure the distance from the slain man to the surrounding cities. And it shall be that the elders of the city nearest the slain man will take a heifer which has not been worked, and which has not pulled a yoke with a yoke. And the elders of the city shall bring the heifer down to the valley with flowing water, which is neither plowed nor sown, and they shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests, the sons of the Levites, shall come near. For the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him. So that's what the Levites in that city would do. They come out whenever there's an unsolved murder. They got finally called out of retirement for a day. God has chosen them to minister to him and to bless in the name of the Lord. By their word, every controversy and every assault shall be settled. And all the elders of that city nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck has been broken in the valley. And they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, nor have our eyes seen it. Provide atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, and do not lay innocent blood on to the charge of your people Israel. And the atonement shall be provided on their behalf for the blood. So you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. Basically, the law consistently taught that innocent blood should never go unatoned for. If the murderer was known, he would be killed for his crime. A murderer was put to death for murder, which would basically settle accounts. That would basically atone for the crime. If the murderer was unknown and therefore could not be executed, there had to be atonement made for it anyway. There had still been a wrongful death occurred, and God was not going to let him just ignore this kind of thing. There still had to be a diligent inquiry made. And whatever city was measured to be closest to the corpse was considered to be responsible. Of course, it's possible that it was someone from another city who'd done it, but there'd be no way of knowing. So it would, by the law of averages, the nearest town would probably house the murderer. And so the priests or the Levites of that town would come out, and the chief leaders of that town would come out, and they'd offer basically a ceremony. Now, it might be interesting to speculate about what the bull represents and why it never had been worked, why its neck was broken and so forth. But I don't know the answer to that. Obviously, the bull died in place of the murderer, and therefore, in some respects, is a type of Christ who died for us, the just for the unjust. But as far as the specifics of an unworked bull and breaking the neck and so forth, I don't have all the answers for that, nor do I have time to speculate on it right now. The point is that they couldn't just leave this thing, they couldn't just turn their back as if nothing had ever happened. They had to do a ceremony to show their legitimate concern that innocent blood not be left unsettled. And this is how they were to do it when they couldn't find the murderer to punish. Verse 15 and 16 and 17 talk about the case in a polygamous marriage. It says if a man has two wives, one is loved and the other is unloved. If they both born him children, both the loved and the unloved, and if the firstborn son is of her who is unloved, as for example was the case with Jacob and his two wives. His firstborn son, Reuben, came from the unloved wife, Leah. Now, it says, in a case like that in the future, then it shall be on the day that he bequeaths his possessions to his sons that he must not bestow firstborn status on the son of the loved wife in preference to the son of the unloved, who is truly the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as his firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has. For he is the beginning of his strength, and the right of the firstborn is his. So really, although Jacob preferred Joseph and Benjamin over his other sons, because Joseph and Benjamin were the only sons born by the wife he loved, yet he had to, even though the law had not yet been given about this, he had to acknowledge who the real firstborn was. The real firstborn was Reuben. But he was disqualified because of his sins. Next in line were Simeon and Levi, but they were disqualified for their sins. And the fourth one, the one who did get the birthright, was Judah. And he too was the son of the unloved wife, Leah. And therefore Jacob apparently followed this principle, though he no doubt would have preferred to give it to Joseph. Firstborn son, regardless of which wife, which mother came from, was the firstborn and deserved the right of the firstborn. Verse 18, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of the city and to the gate of the city. And they shall say to the elders of his city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of this city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall put away the evil person from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Now, it's quite clear it's not talking about little children. The fact that it says he's a drunkard and a glutton indicates that he is mature enough to dictate his own eating habits, which little children don't have the power to do. This is probably an adolescent son. Now, the important thing to realize about this is that it was not a law that God gave just to make sure that sons get put to death. It was a law that was to inhibit rebellion among sons who had gotten old enough to actually physically resist their fathers. A child, whether girl or boy, is very much at the mercy of his father. His father's bigger and stronger. Therefore, the father can and is expected to control the behavior of his little children. But when a son is in his teens, he may be bigger and even stronger than his father. And it is not unheard of for sons to abuse their parents, to beat them up and so forth. I've never known anyone who did this. Well, come to think of it, I have. I know someone who beat up his mom. But I mean, it's not unheard of. Now, what would a parent do if he had a son who simply would disregard him, lived under his roof but wouldn't submit to it, lived as a drunkard and a glutton, and the father had no physical power to restrain him? Well, the community had more power than that son. And therefore, the community was recruited to discipline that son, actually to punish, to judge that son. Again, the idea would be to discourage sons who knew that this was a possible fate, would discourage them from disrespecting their parents, though they were now big enough to do so and get away with it as far as, you know, their father's ability to retaliate is concerned. Yet, there would be no abused parents in that society. Because earlier in Exodus, God said, anyone who strikes his father or mother will be put to death. Here, simply refusal to submit to your parents would be a capital crime. And that is, after being disciplined several times, just remaining obstinate, they'd be put to death. By the way, Israel was described as God's son, and no doubt this resembles God's attitude toward Israel when he disciplined them again and again, and they remained obstinate, they remained unchanged, and eventually he brought judgment upon them, final judgment upon their nation. Then there's a variety of different kinds of laws in the remainder of this chapter and in the next. It says, if a man has committed a sin worthy of death and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain overnight on the tree, but you shall surely bury him that day, so that you will not defile the land which the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. For he who is hanged on a tree is accursed of God. Now, the hanging on the tree here does not refer to hanging by the neck until dead, nor does it directly refer to crucifixion, although it is later applied to Jesus in his crucifixion. The scripture, Paul applies it in Galatians that way. But the idea here is that they did not ordinarily execute people that way. All the times that we've read of someone being put to death for his crimes, they've been stoned to death. And here it says, if a man has done something worthy of death and you put him to death, and you hang him on a tree. The hanging on the tree is what's done after he's dead. We see this in a few cases in the history of Israel. When they wanted to show particular disdain for an enemy that they defeated or for